Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, professor of medicine and chief of gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. Well, Clostridium difficile is not an uncommon topic, unfortunately, in any care provider's mind, and certainly for what we deal with both inpatient and outpatient. The American College of Gastroenterology, under the excellent leadership of Dr. Chris Sarawitz and Dr. Larry Brandt in 2013, issued a guideline that was extremely helpful in providing evidence-based recommendations for clinicians dealing with this. Most recently, in 2018 now, just released, is an update from the Infectious Disease Society of America, or IDSA, and the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, SHEA, or SHEA, to provide even further guidance. And I'm going to contrast the two guidelines and tell you what news is different and what I learned actually in review of some of these guidelines, so you can apply this to your practice. Now, we recognize that C. diff rates are increasing at an alarming rate. There are nearly 500,000 cases of this a year in the United States, and it is incredibly prevalent. The proportion of discharge patients diagnosed with Clostridium difficile has more than doubled over the last 9 years. There are also increased hospital lengths of stay and an increment of nearly 5 days greater when C. diff is diagnosed. And the cost attendant to that, associated with that, is an extra $15,000 for that extended time frame. Healthcare acquired Clostridium difficile has also doubled in the concept of the last decade, from 11% to over 22% in the last several years. So we're seeing this as an increasing problem, and it furthermore is a problem for hospitalized patients, because now under the inpatient prospective payment system, CMS in 2017 added C. diff infection to a penalty rate. So if you're readmitted within 30 days after a C. diff infection in the hospital, there is no payment to that hospital for that stay. Estimated costs for that are around $15,000 to $17,000. So again, huge implications for cost, billions of dollars involved in this amplification of prevention, and certainly prevention of recurrence of C. diff as it relates to repeat hospitalization. So let's talk about what the guidelines say. Well, the first guideline recommendation is to not test if there's no diarrhea, and this is really inordinately apparent. In our hospital, we can't even get the test, or shouldn't get the test, run by the lab unless there's diarrhea. The test is best performed by a toxin and a stool-based testing for glutamate dehydrogenase, and this is an antigen that's present in virtually all strains of C. difficile, so toxigenic and non-toxigenic, and this is then amplified by a test for the specific gene itself, by a toxin immunoassay, or a nucleic amplification assay, which detects the gene that's prevalent in C. difficile as it relates to the toxin. So your lab is doing this, but it's just important to recognize that's the standard. The recommendation two is do not repeat the testing within 7 days during the same episode of diarrhea, and don't test stool from asymptomatic persons, except for if you're doing some type of epidemiologic study. That's really important, because there is some process of evaluation in certain hospitals that I'm aware of where they're trying to pre-test people going into the hospital, and there is not a sufficient evidence recommendation at present. Recognize that 1 to 3% of asymptomatic people carry this, and I'm talking about the adult population in particular, are asymptomatic carriers, even much more prevalent in when you go to some of the extended care facilities, medical facilities like nursing homes and extended care facilities. There is an incredibly high prevalence of asymptomatic carriage, in particular in infants. I don't treat pediatric patients, but there is a very strong recommendation from the current guideline that if you do treat infants, that the asymptomatic carriage is so high that you should not treat, or you should not even screen for C. diff in neonates or infants less than 12 months of age. So in that population, don't even test. In the 1 to 2 year age, there is still a high prevalence and again should not be routinely tested. But if all other causes of diarrhea have been excluded, then you would consider testing for C. diff. So even a high symptom asymptomatic carriage in that 1 to 2 year, never under 12 months. And then over 2 years, you do it as a directed, appropriate as directed if there is a concern. Routine testing is one thing. When you are dealing with this C. diff, and particularly in the hospital, we get all kinds of gowns and gloves. But just a caveat on the way that the guideline recommended it, routine washing with soap and water is better than the disinfection with the alcohol type of disinfections, which a lot of hospitals proffer. And this is more from the disruption of the spores. So the soap and water method before and after is really the recommendation. What about the asymptomatic carrier? Should we treat and test for these people? The recommendation here was there was no recommendation, so we should not be doing that routinely and certainly on the entry into the hospital. There are studies that have looked at this, somewhat problematic from stratification bias, so the recommendation is there is no official policy. What about the role of antibiotic stewardship? Well, we're seeing this as a tremendous emphasis across the board in a variety of different disease states. Diverticulitis, we've reviewed before, antibiotic stewardship in particular, withholding that for several days before the patients really declare themselves is pretty much the new standard. But antibiotics should be targeted based on the local epidemiology of whatever your C. diff strains are present if they're known. But restriction in particular of fluoroquinolones, which seem to be doled out like candy for diverticulitis, for urinary tract infections, clindamycin, we've long known this, and also cephalosporins, except for surgical antibiotic prophylaxis. And this is really a strong recommendation to be better antibiotic stewards in particular. One of the soft recommendations here is what about in patients that are admitted that have had prior C. diff and putting them on antibiotics preventively? Again, not strong recommendation, no good data on this, but if the patient is particularly high risk, it could be considered perhaps at a lower dose, so maybe a 125 milligram vancomycin for a period of time of 10 to 14 days, fidaxomicin for 200 milligrams a day. Again, no official recommendation, but you are seeing some hospitals recommend this. Again, not official from this particular guideline. What about PPIs? PPIs have continued to take lots of heat in the market. And again, from particular allegations of harm, this guideline said, although there was an epidemiologic association with PPIs, the evidence that it certainly that they need to be discontinued is not there, and that there's insufficient evidence that the discontinuance during a particular hospitalization or whatever to prevent C. diff is really not there. They should be continued as appropriate and discontinued as appropriate. Lots of people take these medicines and certainly don't need them. What about the issue about the treatment recommendation? Well, the vancomycin or fidaxomicin now are the first line recommendations. This differs from the C. diff guideline from the American College of Gastroenterology, where in mild to moderate metronidazole was recommended. The new guidelines from the Infectious Disease and Epidemiology Associations say that vancomycin or fidaxomicin, again, new recommendations to include fidaxomicin for the initial episode, so it was 125 milligrams four times a day for vancomycin or fidaxomicin, 200 milligrams twice daily for 10 days. Previous guideline recommendations have said 10 to 14 days and recognize it's 10 days. Also very important, highlighted in the 2013 guideline for the American College, is the important point that vancomycin can be given as a compounded medication. So get your pharmacy to do compounding of the IV formulation, 125 milligrams four times a day, rather than the commercially available encapsulated vancomycin. The cost savings is considerable by a factor of anywhere from 10 to 15 times cheaper by using a compounding pharmacy. Again, very, very important. If you don't have availability of vanco or the fidaxomicin, the recommendation from the Infectious Disease Society is still metronidazole, 500 milligrams three times a day for 10 days. Repeat dosing with metronidazole is not recommended, in particular because of some of the irreversible neurotoxicity associated. What about fulminant toxicity in C. diff, fulminant C. diff? The recommendation from the new guideline is to use vancomycin orally, and this time we start with 500 milligrams four times a day. Or in patients that are in particular have ileus, the recommendation is to give 500 milligrams and approximately 100 cc's of normal saline every 6 hours as a retention enema, and combine both of these in particular with a patient with an ileus, as well as to give metronidazole and to give this 500 milligrams every 8 hours. So again, in fulminant toxicity in CDI, this is a recommendation. The recurrence is a real problem, because if we have a one-time episode of C. diff, the recurrence rate is typically within the first 3 months, but it's 15%. If you have a second recurrence, it goes up to 35% chance of recurrence. In particular, a third chance, you go to 65 and then to 85. So the recurrence seems to compound very quickly. The new recommendation is the first recurrence of C. diff with oral vancomycin should be given as a standard, followed by a tapered pulse recommendation. In this case, the pulse recommendation is somewhat soft. The recommendation from the American College guideline in 2013 was vanco followed by for four times a day, followed by a twice a day every third day for 10 doses. The current guideline from the ID societies recommends that a tapered dose and a pulse dose would be BID after the 10-day course for a week, then once a day for a week, and then once every 2 to 3 days for 8 to 10 weeks. I'm a little bit concerned about vancomycin-resistant enterococcus in that particular, but again, a pulse dose after the first treatment is the new standard as it's recommended. The alternative would be that you could have a treatment with fidaxomicin for 10 days. There is some recommendation about also using rifaximin after a standard dose of vancomycin. Good luck getting that paid for. You won't have that. And again, to consider fecal transplant in patients with multiple recurrences. The American College of Gastro recommended after the third recurrence, I would suggest that maybe even the fulminant toxicity of a one-time is enough to recommend that. One soft recommendation here was, or not the recommendation even, but discussed in the evidence discussion, was in the patients that are going to undergo fecal transplant to consider a 3 to 4 day course of vancomycin prior to that fecal transplant, just to reduce the stool burden of the vegetative spore for C. diff. I think that's a reasonable thing to consider. No strong evidence here, but again, not unreasonable. And then discontinue it the day before you do the fecal transplant. The patient populations that really were discussed, but not really evidence-based recommendations, also included patients that come in and they get treated for C. diff, but they continue to need their antibiotics. What do we do with those patients? The recommendation was really to still stop it at the end of the 10-day course, even in the face of continued antibiotics, but consider in high-risk patients perhaps an empiric continuation, and it may be that you go to vancomycin 125 milligrams daily or fidaxomicin 200 milligrams daily, but here the evidence was very, very much lacking. So no official recommendation for those people that get treated in the hospital, need continued antibiotics, and what do you do with those? The last is a recommendation about looking at probiotics, and this is a really serious kind of moving target, but there is evidence in the American College of Gastroenterology guideline, as well in the current guideline, do not recommend use of probiotics. Lactobacillus and Saccharomyces species have been purported as potential benefit. These should not be used in the ICU patients. If you choose to use these when patients with indwelling catheters, there are reports of bacteremias and fungemias in these patients when exposed to these type of probiotics. I'm not personally a fan of this, but certainly the recommendation here doesn't suggest that these should be used routinely. And certainly the two guidelines, the American College guideline and the current ID guidelines, do not recommend this as a routine prophylaxis. So, a bit new here as it relates to C. diff. It's not an uncommon problem. It's a very expensive problem, one that's very prevalent, incredible cost involved, and it's a leading cause of nosocomial-related death in the United States. We have a long way to go to prevent retreatment, and is a daily ongoing issue of concern and topic discussion. So hopefully these new guideline recommendations will provide you some guidance in your next caveat in dealing with a patient with C. diff. The other caveat that I would lead this with is extensive hand washing is important, but a recommendation to high-level disinfection of bathrooms, and this is something that's not addressed in the current guideline. This is the David Johnson recommendation, but the spores can live on in the vegetative state, in particular on countertops and surface areas. So go home and disinfect with high-level mechanical disruption, scrubbing, and then mechanical and followed by a high-level disinfection exposure, Clorox-type-based treatment for the bathrooms, the surface areas, the toothbrush. These spores can be shed from the toilet, and toilet microbiology in the bathroom is fairly well known. But it is a strong evidence that this can be spread and these people can auto-reinfect. So when you treat these people, tell them about this before when they go home, that they need to do a toilet and bathroom high-level disinfection. That's a DHE recommendation, not evidence-based, but it is strong. In my practice, I do this routinely, and I think it would be helpful for you to incorporate. The other guideline recommendations hopefully will provide you guidance when you're dealing with the next patient you see with C. diff. I'm Dr. David Johnson. Thanks again for listening.